How do I know if I can trust someone enough to be vulnerable? How can I build trust without ever risking vulnerability? The research is clear, but not a huge relief for those of us who would prefer a scoring system or a fail-proof trust test, or that app that we just talked about. We need to trust to be vulnerable, and we need to be vulnerable in order to build trust. The research participants described trust as a slow-building, iterative, and layered process that happens over time. Both trust-building and rumbling with vulnerability involve risk. That's what makes courage hard and rare. In our work, we use the metaphor of the marble jar. I first wrote about this in Daring Greatly, but I'll share the story again here. When my daughter Ellen was in third grade, she came home from school one day, closed the door behind her, looked at me, and then literally slid down the front door, buried her face in her hands, and started sobbing. My response, of course, was, "Oh my God, Ellen, are you okay? What happened?" "Something really embarrassing happened at school today, and I shared it with my friends, and they promised not to tell anyone. But by the time we got back to class, everyone in my whole class knew." I could feel the slow rising of my internal mama bear. Ellen told me that it had been so bad that Miss Baucom, her third grade teacher, took half the marbles out of the marble jar. In her classroom, there's a big jar for marbles. When the class collectively makes good decisions, they get to put marbles into the jar. When the class collectively makes bad decisions, marbles come out. Miss Baucom took marbles out because everyone was laughing, apparently, at Ellen. I told my daughter how sorry I was, and then she looked at me and said, "I will never trust anyone again in my life." My heart was breaking with hers. My first thought was, "Damn straight. You trust your mama, and that's it. And when you go to college, I'm going to get a little apartment right next to your dorm, and you can come and talk to me." An appealing idea at the time. But instead, I put my fears and anger aside and started trying to figure out how to talk to her about trust and connection. As I was searching for the right way to translate my own experiences of trust and what I was learning about trust from the research, I thought, the marble jar. Perfect. I told Ellen, "We trust the people who have earned marbles over time in our life. Whenever someone supports you or is kind to you or sticks up for you, or honors what you share with them as private, you put marbles in the jar. When people are mean or disrespectful or share your secrets, marbles come out. We look for people who, over time, put marbles in and in and in, until you look up one day and they're holding a full jar. Those are the folks you can tell your secrets to. Those are the folks you trust with information that's important to you." And then I asked her if she had a friend with a full marble jar. "Yes, I've got marble jar friends. Hannah and Lorna are my marble jar friends." And I asked her to tell me how they earn marbles. I was really curious, and I expected her to recount dramatic stories of the girls doing heroic things for her. Instead, she said something that shocked me even more. "Well, I was at a soccer game last weekend, and Hannah looked up and told me that she saw Oma and Opa." Those are my parents. That's my mom and my stepdad. I pushed Ellen for more details. "Then what?" "No, that's it. I gave her a marble." "Why?" "Well, not everyone has 8 grandparents." I smiled, "because my parents are divorced and remarried, and Steve's parents are divorced and remarried." Ellen said, "I think it's really cool that Hannah remembers all of their names." She continued, "Well, Lorna is also my marble jar friend because she will do the half-butt sit with me." My very understandable response, "Lord have mercy, what is that?" "If I come in too late to the cafeteria and all the tables are full, she'll scoot over and just take half the seat and give me the other half of the seat so I can sit at the friend table." I had to agree with her that the half-butt sit was really great and certainly deserving of a marble. Perking up, she asked me if I have marble jar friends and how they earn their marbles. "Well, I think it might be different for grown-ups." But then I thought back to the soccer game that Ellen was referring to. When my parents arrived, my friend Eileen had walked up and said, "Hey, David and Deanne, it's great to see you." And I remember feeling how much it had meant to me that Eileen had remembered their names. I tell you the story because I had always assumed that trust is earned in big moments and through really grand gestures, not the more simple things like a friend remembering small details in your life. Later that night, I called the doctoral students on my team and we spent 5 days going through all of the research around trust. We started looking into trust-earning behaviors, which enforced what Ellen had taught me after school that day. It turns out that trust is, in fact, earned in the smallest of moments. It is earned not through heroic deeds or even highly visible actions, but through paying attention, listening, and gestures of genuine care and connection. As a grounded theory researcher, it's my job to figure out what the data say and then jump into the literature to see how my findings fit or don't fit with what other researchers are reporting. Either way, the theory that emerges doesn't change, but if there's a conflict, which happens often, the researcher has to acknowledge it. Most quantitative researchers go the other way, looking first at what existing research says and then trying to confirm whether it's true. In my approach, I develop theories based on lived experiences, not existing theories. Only after I capture the participants' experiences do I try to place my theories in the existing research. Grounded theory researchers do it in that order so that our conclusions about the data aren't skewed by existing theories that may or may not reflect real experiences by diverse populations. The first place I turned to see what was in the existing literature was John Gottman's research, which is based on 40 years of studying intimate relationships. For those of you unfamiliar with Gottman's work on marriages, he was able to predict an outcome of divorce with 90% accuracy based on responses to a series of questions. His team screened for what he called the four horsemen of the apocalypse: criticism, defensiveness, stonewalling, and contempt, with contempt being the most damning in a romantic partnership. In an article on one of my go-to websites, the University of California, Berkeley's Greater Good, greatergood.berkeley.edu, Gottman describes trust building with our partners in a manner totally consistent with what I found in my research. Gottman writes, "What I have found through research is that trust is built in very small moments, which I call sliding door moments, after the movie Sliding Doors. In any interaction, there is a possibility of connecting with your partner or turning away from your partner. Let me give you an example of that from my own relationship. One night, I really wanted to finish a mystery novel. I thought I knew who the killer was, but I was anxious to find out. At one point in the night, I put the novel on my bedside and walked into the bathroom. As I passed the mirror, I saw my wife's face in the reflection, and she looked sad, brushing her hair. There was a sliding door moment. I had a choice. I could sneak out of the bathroom and think, I don't want to deal with her sadness tonight. I want to read my novel. But instead, because I'm a sensitive researcher of relationships, I decided to go into the bathroom. I took the brush from her hand and asked, 'What's the matter, baby?' And she told me why she was sad. Now, at that moment, I was building trust. I was there for her. I was connecting with her rather than choosing to think only about what I wanted. These are the moments, we've discovered, that build trust. One such moment is not that important, but if you're always choosing to turn away, then trust erodes in a relationship, very gradually, very slowly." So what I have found really aligns with what Gottman has found. Trust is the stacking and layering of small moments and reciprocal vulnerability over time. Trust and vulnerability grow together, and to betray one is to destroy both. Myth number six, vulnerability is disclosure. Apparently, there is a misconception in some circles that I am a proponent of leaders disclosing personal experiences and openly sharing emotions in all cases. I think that notion stems from people only having a peripheral understanding of the key themes of my TEDx Houston talk on vulnerability and the book Daring Greatly, combined with the fact that 80% of the work that I do today is about vulnerability and leadership. It's a bad case of the 2+2=57 craziness that we see in the world today. We all know people, and we've all been the people, who add up a couple of things that we think we understand and come to a clear, somewhat interesting, and totally false conclusion. Let's dispel that myth right off the bat with two seemingly conflicting statements. Number one, I am not a proponent of oversharing, indiscriminate disclosure as a leadership tool, or vulnerability for vulnerability's sake. Number two, there is no daring leadership without vulnerability. Both of these are true statements. I know there's a problem when people ask me how much I think leaders should share with their colleagues or employees. Some of the most daring leaders I know have incredible vulnerability rumbling skills, yet disclose very little. I've also worked with leaders who share way more than they should and demonstrate little to no rumbling skills. During a time of difficult change and uncertainty, a daring leader might sit with their team and say something like this: "Look, these changes are coming in hard and fast, and I know there's a lot of anxiety, I'm feeling it too, and it's hard to work through. It's hard not to take it home, it's hard not to worry, and it's easy for all of us to want to look for someone to blame. I will share everything I can about the changes with you as soon as I can. I want to spend the next 45 minutes rumbling on how we're all managing the change. Specifically, what does support from me look like? What questions can I try to answer? Are there any stories you want to check out with me? Are there any questions that you have? I'm asking everyone to stay connected and lean into each other during this churn so we can really rumble with what's going on. In the midst of all of this, we still need to produce work that makes us proud. Let's each write down one thing we need from our team in order to feel okay sharing and asking questions. And then let's write down one thing that will get in the way of us being honest with each other. This is a great example of rumbling with vulnerability. The leader is naming some of the unsaid emotions and creating what we call a safe container by asking the team what they need to feel open and safe in the conversation. This is one of the easiest practices to implement, and the return on the time investment is huge in terms of trust building and improving the quality of feedback and conversation. Yet I rarely see team, project, or group leaders take this time. In Google's 5-year study on highly productive teams, Project Aristotle, they found that psychological safety, team members feeling safe to take risks and be vulnerable in front of each other, was, quote, far and away the most important of the 5 dynamics that set successful teams apart, end quote. Harvard Business School professor Amy Edmondson coined the phrase psychological safety. In her book Teaming, she writes, simply put, psychological safety makes it possible to give tough feedback and have difficult conversations without the need to tiptoe around the truth. In psychologically safe environments, people believe that if they make a mistake, others will not penalize or think less of them for it. They also believe that others will not resent or humiliate them when they ask for help or information. This belief comes about when people both trust and respect each other, and it produces a sense of confidence that the group won't embarrass, reject, or punish someone for speaking up. Thus, psychological safety is a taken-for-granted belief about how others will respond when you ask a question, seek feedback, admit a mistake, or propose a possibly wacky idea. Most people feel a need to manage interpersonal risk to retain a good image, especially at work, and especially in the presence of those who formally evaluate them. This need is both instrumental, promotions and rewards may depend on impressions held by bosses and others, and socio-emotional, we simply prefer approval over disapproval. Psychological safety does not imply a cozy situation in which people are necessarily close friends, nor does it suggest an absence of pressure or problems. In our container building work, the team would review all of the items they wrote down and then work together to consolidate and match items to come up with some ground rules. Items that frequently show up as things that get in the way of psychological safety in teams and groups include judgment, unsolicited advice giving, interrupting, and sharing outside the team meeting. The behaviors that people need from their team or group almost always include listening, staying curious, being honest, and keeping confidence. Dare to lead by investing 20 minutes in creating psychological safety when you need to rumble. Make your intention of creating safety explicit and get your team's help on how to do it effectively. What I also love about this example is how the leader is being honest about the struggle, staying calm while naming the anxiety and how it might be showing up, and giving people the opportunity to ask questions and reality check the rumor mill. What I really appreciate about this approach is one of my favorite rumble tools. What does support from me look like? Not only does it offer the opportunity for clarity and set up the team for success, asking people for specific examples of what supportive behaviors look like and what they don't look like also holds them accountable for asking for what they need. When you put this question into practice, expect to see people struggling to come up with examples of supportive behaviors. We're much more accustomed to not asking for exactly what we need and then being resentful or disappointed that we didn't get it. Also, most of us can tell you what support does not look like more easily than we can come up with what it does look like. Over time, this practice is a huge grounded confidence builder. We'll talk about the concept of grounded confidence later. In this Rumble example, the leader is not oversharing or disclosing inappropriately as a mechanism for hotwiring connection or trust with people. There's no fake vulnerability. I mean, fake vulnerability can look like a leader telling us that we can ask questions but not taking the time to create the psychological safety to do it, or not even offering a pause in the conversation for anyone else to speak. This leader is also not shirking the responsibility of attending to the team's fears and feelings by oversharing and sympathy-seeking with statements like, "Look, y'all, I'm really falling apart too. I don't know what to do either. I'm not the enemy here." Basically, feel sorry for me and don't hold me accountable for leading through this hard time because I'm scared too. Ugh, that does not work. Not only is fake vulnerability ineffective, but it breeds distrust. There's no faster way to piss off people than to try to manipulate them with vulnerability. Vulnerability is not a personal marketing tool. It is not an oversharing strategy. Rumbling with vulnerability is about leaning in rather than walking away from the situations that make us feel uncertain, at risk, or emotionally exposed. We should always be clear about our intention, understand the limits of vulnerability in the context of roles and relationships, and set boundaries. Boundaries is a slippery word, but I love how my friend Kelly Ray Roberts makes it so simple and powerful. She's an artist, and several years ago, she wrote a blog post about how people can and cannot use her copyrighted work. The post had two lists, what's okay and what's not okay. It was crystal clear and completely captured what had emerged from the data we collected on effective boundary setting. Today, we teach that setting boundaries is making clear what's okay and what's not okay, and why. Vulnerability minus boundaries is not vulnerability. It's confession, manipulation, desperation, shock and awe. It can be a lot of things, but it's not vulnerability. As an example of what vulnerability is not, I sometimes tell the story of a young CEO who was 6 months into his first round of investment funding. He came up to me after a talk and said, "I get it. I'm in. I'm drinking the Kool-Aid. I am going to get really vulnerable with my people." Whew. My first thought was, oh man, here we go. First, when people talk about drinking the Kool-Aid, I get skeptical. It's a pretty terrible reference, and if you have to turn off your critical thinking and chug the groupthink juice to be down with an idea or get on board with a plan, I'm already concerned. Second, if you run up to me excited about becoming more vulnerable, you must really not understand the concept. If, on the other hand, you come up to me and say, "Okay, I think I get it, and I'm going to try to embrace the suck of vulnerability," I'm pretty sure you understand what's involved. The conversation with this guy started with multiple flags, not enough for a parade, but close. I gave him a nervous smile and said, "Say more." Another favorite Rumble tool. Asking someone to say more often leads to profoundly deeper and more productive rumbling. Context and details matter. Peel the onion. Stephen Covey's sage advice still stands. Seek first to understand, then to be understood. The excited CEO explained, "I'm just going to tell the investors in my team the truth. I am completely in over my head, we're bleeding money, and I have no idea what I'm doing." He paused and looked at me. "What do you think?" I took his hand and led him to the side of the room, and we sat down. I looked at him and repeated what I had said in the talk, but what he apparently missed. "What do I think? I think you won't secure any more funding and that you're going to scare the shit out of some people. Vulnerability without boundaries is not vulnerability. It might be fear or anxiety. We have to think about why we're sharing and equally important with whom. What are their roles? What is our role? Is this sharing productive and appropriate?" Before we go any further with a story, when I'm talking to a group, I always stop and ask the audience this question. We probably all agree that standing in front of our employees and investors with this confession is not smart. But here's the question. If everyone listening right now, I'll just make this question for y'all listening to the book on audio. If every one of you had a full year's salary invested in this guy's company, how many of you would be hoping that he's sitting down across from someone saying, "I'm completely in over my head, we're bleeding money, and I have no idea what I'm doing"? So here's the thing. If there are 1,000 people in a room and I pose this scenario, 2 or 3 might nervously raise their hand as they become increasingly aware of being in a tiny minority. The only exception was in a room of 50 venture capitalists. They all raised their hands. I break the tension by raising my hand, explaining my thinking. If I've got money invested in his company, I pray that he's sitting down with a mentor, an advisor, a board member, someone, and being really honest about what's happening. Why? Because we all know the alternative. He keeps pretending and hustling and grinding on the same ineffective changes until everything is gone. Now, if I were the guy, I wouldn't stand up in front of all my investors or my team of friends and colleagues who left great jobs to come work with me to turn my vision into a reality and spill my guts like that. It's just not good judgment. When I asked him why he'd share that with them rather than an advisor or mentor who might be able to help him without becoming personally panicked, he revealed what I call the stealth intention and the stealth expectation. The stealth intention is a self-protection need that lurks beneath the surface and often drives behavior outside our values. Closely related to this is the stealth expectation, a desire or expectation that exists outside of our awareness and typically includes a dangerous combination of fear and magical thinking. Stealth expectations almost always lead to disappointment, resentment, and more fear. His answer to my question about why he would share this with everyone was, "I'm not sure. I guess I want them to know I'm trying. I want them to know that I'm doing the best I can, that I'm a good guy, but I'm failing. If I tell them the truth and get really vulnerable, they won't blame me or hate me. They'll understand." So the stealth intention here is I can protect myself from rejection, shame, judgment, and people turning away from me and thinking I'm a bad person if I share this vulnerability. The stealth expectation is they won't turn away from me and think I'm a bad person. Trust me when I tell you that stealth intentions and expectations are things I have to wrestle with often, sometimes on a daily basis. I've wanted to shout the same thing that this guy wanted to shout to my own team for the same reasons. But I've had enough practice to know that vulnerability is not a sympathy-seeking tool. As a leader, he needs to stay honest with his team and investors, and this vulnerable conversation needs to happen with someone who can help him lead through it. Sharing just to share without understanding your role, recognizing professional boundaries, and getting clear on your intentions and expectations, especially those flying under the radar, is just purging or venting or gossip or a million other things that are often propelled by hidden needs. More than occasionally, I find that the people who misrepresent my work on vulnerability and conflate it with disclosure or emotional purging either don't understand it or they have so much personal resistance to the notion of being vulnerable that they stretch the concept until it appears ridiculous and easy to discount. In either case, if you come across an explanation of vulnerability that doesn't include setting boundaries or being clear on intentions, proceed with caution. Vulnerability for vulnerability's sake is not effective, useful, or smart. To feel is to be vulnerable. For those of us who are raised with a healthier and unhealthy dose of suck it up and get her done, rumbling with vulnerability is a challenge. The myths that we just talked about work together to lead us to believe that vulnerability is the gooey center of the hard emotions that we work full time to avoid feeling, much less discussing, even when our avoidance causes us and the people around us pain. Emotions like fear, shame, grief, disappointment, and sadness. But vulnerability isn't just the center of hard emotions. It's the core of all emotions. To feel is to be vulnerable. Believing that vulnerability is weakness is believing that feeling is weakness. And like it or not, we are emotional beings. What most of us fail to understand, and what took me a decade of research to learn, is that vulnerability is the cradle of emotions and experiences that we crave. Vulnerability is the birthplace of love, belonging, and joy. We know that vulnerability is the cornerstone of courage building, but we often fail to realize that without vulnerability, there is no creativity or innovation. Why? Because there is nothing more uncertain than the creative process, and there is absolutely no innovation without failure. Show me a culture in which vulnerability is framed as weakness, and I'll show you a culture struggling to come up with fresh ideas and new perspectives. I love what Amy Poehler has to say in her web series, Smart Girls Ask Amy. She says, "It's very hard to have ideas. It's very hard to put yourself out there. It's very hard to be vulnerable. But those people who do that are the dreamers, the thinkers, and the creators. They are the magic people of the world. Adaptability to change, hard conversations, feedback, problem solving, ethical decision making, recognition, resilience, and all the other skills that underpin daring leadership are all born of vulnerability. To foreclose on vulnerability in our emotional life out of the fear that the cost will be too high is to walk away from the very thing that gives purpose and meaning to living. As the neuroscientist Antonio Damasio reminds us, we are not necessarily thinking machines. We are feeling machines that think. In the next section, we'll break down one of my own leadership stories to better understand how fear and feelings left unattended can cause major problems, and we'll explore more rumbling language, skills, tools, and practices. Section 2, the call to courage. In the earliest days of building our company, I found myself sitting at a table with my team after they asked if we could meet for an hour. When I realized there was no agenda, I got that sinking, oh God, what now feeling. Charles, our CFO, looked at me and said, "We need to rumble with you on a growing concern about how we're working together." For years, my first thought in a situation like this would have been, oh God, it's an intervention and I'm the intervenee. But I trust my team and I trust the rumble process. Chaz, as I've called him for 25 years, cut right to the chase. We keep setting unrealistic timelines, working frantically to meet them, failing, setting new timelines, and still not meeting them. It's keeping us in constant chaos and people are burning out. When you set a timeline and we push back because we know it's not attainable, you get so insistent that we stop pushing. It's not working. You have a lot of strengths, Brené, but you're not good at estimating time, and we need to find a new process that works for all of us. As my team sat there looking anxious for me to respond and relieved that the issue was on the table regardless of my response, I thought about the first time I heard someone say, "You're not good at estimating time." And I drifted off to the memory of an almost fight I had with Steve a decade before this meeting. Steve and I, along with our next door neighbors, signed up to host a progressive dinner party to raise money for our daughter's PTO. Steve and I were in charge of appetizers and salad at our house. Then the guests would walk next door for dinner, then back to our house for dessert and coffee. Very retro, very fun. Everything sounds easy when it's months away. I remember exactly where I was standing when I looked at Steve and said, "This is going to be great. I'm excited about the new recipes. All we need to do is get the house ready. I can do a little paint touch-up in the dining room, and I need you to add some pops of color in the front yard. I need the yard to say, 'Welcome, we're glad you're here. These flowers are evidence that we're awesome neighbors who have our shit together.'" Steve just stared at me. I glared back at him. "What? Why are you looking at me like that?" Steve said, "The dinner party starts in 2 hours. "I know," I said. "I've thought about it. It'll take you 15 minutes to get to Home Depot, 30 minutes to pick out the right combination of flowers, 15 minutes to get home, 45 minutes to plant them, and then 15 minutes to take a shower." Steve couldn't speak. He just stood there shaking his head until I said, "What? What's wrong?" He looked at me and said, "You're not good at estimating time, Brené." I quipped back without thinking. Maybe I'm just faster than most people. I drew a deep breath, immediately regretting being a smartass when I needed him to hightail it to Home Depot. I responded to my own comment before he could. "Really? Why do you think I'm bad at estimating time?" "Well, for starters," he said, "you didn't factor in the hour we're going to need for the fight that's going to break out when I say, 'Hell no, I'm not going to landscape the yard 2 hours before company comes.' And then you respond by accusing me of never caring about the details or worrying about the little things. You'll say my lack of attention to detail is why you're so stressed out all the time. Then you'll say something like, 'It must be nice not to have to worry about the little things that make a big difference.'" I just stood there. The fact that he was saying all this in a kind way and not being crappy made it worse. He continued, "Your 'must be nice' comment is going to feel like blame and criticism, and it's going to piss me off. All of the stress of hosting this party is going to escalate things. You'll try not to cry because you don't want puffy eyes, but we'll both end up in tears. We'll spend the rest of the night just wanting this whole party to be over. So, We're not going to get flowers, and I think we should skip the fight, given our tight timeline. His prophecy forced me into a weepy laugh. Okay, that was painful and funny. Steve said, the best thing you can do right now is to go for a run and take a shower. What people see is what they get. As I pulled myself back from this memory and into my seat at the table with my team, I found myself deeply grateful for Chaz's clarity. Over our years of researching and working together, we've learned something about clarity that has changed everything from the way we talk to each other to the way we negotiate with external partners. It's simple, but transformative. Clear is kind. Unclear is unkind. I first heard this saying 2 decades ago in a 12-step meeting, but I was on slogan overload at the time, and I didn't even think about it again until I saw the data about how most of us avoid clarity because we tell ourselves that we're being kind, when actually doing this is being unkind and unfair. Feeding people half-truths or bullshit to make them feel better, which is actually almost always about making ourselves feel more comfortable, that's unkind. Not getting clear with a colleague about your expectations because it feels too hard, yet holding them accountable or blaming them for not delivering, is unkind. Talking about people rather than to them is unkind. This lesson has so wildly transformed my life that we live by it at home. If Ellen is trying to figure out how to handle a college roommate issue, or Charlie needs to talk to a friend about something, clear is kind, unclear is unkind. I looked at my team and said, thank you for trusting me enough to tell me this. It's not the first or even the 100th time I've heard this feedback about my sucky time estimation skills. I'm going to work on it. I'm going to get better. I could tell they were a little disappointed in my response. The, okay, I get it and I'll work on it, is a common shutdown technique. I took a deep breath and leaned into the mother of all rumble tools, curiosity. Tell me more about how this plays out for y'all. I want to understand. I'm glad I asked. I needed to hear what they had to say, and they needed me to hear how frustrating, demoralizing, and unproductive it was for me to continue pitching ideas and timelines that were completely unrealistic, and then looking at them like they were crushing my dream when they did their jobs by being honest and saying, that will take at least 12 months, not 2 months, and it will require a significant cash investment. It was painful and uncomfortable, which is exactly why we try to wrap things up quickly and get the hell out of conversations like this. It's so much easier to say, got it, on it, and run. After listening, I thanked them for their courage and honesty, and I promised that I would think about it. I asked if we could circle back the next day. In my research and in my life, I've found absolutely no benefit to pushing through a hard conversation unless there's an urgent, time-sensitive issue at hand. I've never regretted taking a short break or circling back after a few hours of thinking time. I have, however, regretted many instances where I pushed through to get it over and done with. Those self-serving instincts end up costing way more time than a short break. When I got home that evening, I downloaded a couple of books on project management, and for some reason, I don't know, maybe something I read on LinkedIn, I convinced myself that I needed a Six Sigma black belt. I had no idea what that even meant, but I Googled it, and after reading about it for a few minutes, the thought of it made me want to knock myself unconscious with my laptop. It didn't take long before I realized that my plan wasn't going to work. I'm not good at time or things with hard edges, like Tetris or Blocus. I don't think that way or see the world that way. I see projects in constellations, not lines. I see plans the way I see data, relationally and with rounded corners and a million connection ports. As much as I read and tried, it felt like a strange and terrible spreadsheet world to me. Interested in an example of how I think? Okay, brace yourself. When I realized that I couldn't return to my team and impress them with my shiny new black belt and laser-like time estimations, it made me think immediately of Luke Skywalker struggling to become a Jedi warrior in The Empire Strikes Back. I share my love for the story in Rising Strong, but I'll share it here again because there's no such thing as too much Star Wars. Yoda is trying to teach Luke how to use the Force and how the dark side of the Force, anger, fear, and aggression, is holding him back. Luke and Yoda are in the swamp where they've been training when Luke points toward a dark cave at the base of a giant tree. And looking at Yoda, Luke says, "There's something not right here. I feel cold. Death." Yoda explains to Luke that the cave is dangerous and strong with the dark side of the Force. Luke looks confused and afraid, but Yoda's response is simply, "In you must go." When Luke asks what's in the cave, Yoda explains, "Only what you take with you." As Luke straps on his weapons, Yoda hauntingly advises, "Your weapons you will not need." Luke grabs his lightsaber anyway. The cave is dark and scary. As Luke slowly makes his way through it, he is confronted by his enemy, Darth Vader. They both draw their sabers, and Luke quickly cuts off Vader's helmeted head. The head rolls to the ground, and the face guard blows off the helmet. Only it isn't Darth Vader's face that's revealed. It's Luke's face. Luke is staring at his own head on the ground. This parable got me thinking about the possibility that maybe the problem was less about my time estimation and project management skills and more about my fears. So I wrote down a couple of very specific examples of timelines that I forced on my reluctant team. And sure enough, the biggest enemy was not a lack of estimation skills, but a lack of personal awareness. Was I cutting off my own head with a lightsaber? I discovered that my unreasonable timelines were seldom driven by excitement or ambition. I drive these unattainable timelines for two reasons. One, I'm feeling fear, scarcity, and anxiety. For example, we're not doing enough. Someone else is going to think of this idea before we get it done. Or, look what everyone else is doing. Or two, in addition to the daily work we do together, I'm often holding visions of longer-term university commitments, publishing contracts, and a dozen potential collaboration conversations in my head. Sometimes I'm pushing timelines because I'm trying to sync up the timing on projects and deadlines that my team doesn't even know about because I failed to share. It was powerful to figure out the source of the issue, but that didn't translate to wanting to circle back with my team about these key learnings. I didn't want to say, "I'm actually not good at the time estimation piece, and the more I understand that skill set, the less confident I am that I'll actually get much better." I didn't want to share the truth about my fear. What if the scarcity and anxiety are happening because I have no business being a leader? Even being honest about my failure to communicate larger strategy was daunting. What if my communication fails are just symptomatic of my being in over my head trying to run businesses? The most critical thing that the shame gremlins kept whispering during this process was, "You don't belong in this job. You study leadership, but you can't lead. You're a joke." When we're in fear or an emotion is driving self-protection, there's a fairly predictable pattern of how we assemble our armor piece by piece. Step one, I am not enough. Step two, if I'm honest with them about what's happening, they'll think less of me or maybe even use it against me. Step three, no way am I going to be honest about this. No one else does it. Why do I have to put myself out there? Step four, yeah, screw them. I don't see them being honest about what scares them. And they've got plenty of issues. Step five, it's actually their issues and shortcomings that make me act this way. This is their fault, and they're trying to blame me. Step six, where the armor is complete. In fact, now that I think about it, I'm actually better than them. People think it's a long walk from I'm not enough to I'm better than them, but it's actually just standing still in the exact same place, in fear, assembling the armor. I don't want to live in fear or lead from fear, and I'm sick to death of the armor. Courage and faith are my core values, and when I'm in fear, I show up in ways that leave me feeling out of alignment with these values and outside my integrity. This is when I remember Joseph Campbell's quote, which I believe is one of the purest calls to courage for leaders. "The cave you fear to enter holds the treasure you seek." Campbell consulted with George Lucas on Star Wars, and there's no question in my mind that my favorite scene is Lucas bringing this wisdom to life. This is how I think. No black belt, but I have to believe that the Force is with me. Treasure hunting. What is the treasure I seek? Less fear, scarcity, and anxiety. Less feeling alone. More working together toward goals that excite all of us. What is the cave I fear to enter? I'm afraid to admit that I don't know how to do some of the things that I think all, you know, quote, real leaders, end quote, know how to do. I don't want to share that when I'm scared, I make bad decisions, and I have felt stuck and scared, tired and lonely a lot lately. When I sat down with my team for our circle back, we started the meeting with one of our rituals, permission slips. We each wrote down one thing we gave ourselves permission to do or feel for this meeting. Sometimes we do it on post-it notes, but I prefer to write in my journal so that in addition to my meeting notes, I have a reminder of what I was feeling that day. That afternoon, I gave myself permission to be honest with my team about my experiences and the stories I make up about sharing my feelings. Two of the other permissions I remember my team sharing that day were listen with passion and ask for breaks when we need them. Permission slips are powerful. I've seen people, after coming into meetings hell-bent on getting approval for their idea or plan, instead give themselves permission to stay open-minded or to listen more than they talk. I've also heard, I give myself permission to ask for more time to think about something before I share my point of view, or I give myself permission to be present here, even though I'm getting pulled in other directions today. We love permission slips. Because, just like when I used to sign a permission slip to allow Ellen or Charlie to go to the zoo with their class, they still had to get it to the teacher and get on the bus. Just because you write down permission to speak up, even though I'm the only person here who isn't a content expert, doesn't mean that you're going to do it. Permission slips aren't promissory notes. They are for stating and writing down intentions only. So there are no repercussions if you fail to deliver. However, they are useful for increasing accountability and the potential for support, and also for understanding where everyone in the room is coming from. After we shared permission slips, I told them about my unsuccessful experience reading the business books. I explained how I discovered that fear, anxiety, and scarcity were driving my unrealistic timelines, and how I got even more fearful when they responded with the realities of contingencies and critical paths. I walked them through what it felt like for me when they pushed back about timelines that I had calculated based on a million moving pieces, some of which were completely off their radar. Because we're a close group and they work their asses off, it was hard to tell them that I can feel completely alone in trying to keep and coordinate all of the balls in the air. Basically, I owned that all of my timeline pushing stemmed from fear. And rather than being honest about those feelings and owning them, I would offload the emotions on them with anger and the really shitty behavior of looking at them like they were dream crushers. I told them about trying to read the books on project management and estimation skills and believing that the time estimation part of my brain might be missing. They did not respond with, no, Brene, it's not missing, you're good. Instead, they actually agreed. Murdoch, my manager, kindly said, yeah, it could be missing, but the good news is that it makes more room in your brain for all that creativity. We also laughed really hard about the black belt. We identified four key learnings during our rumble. First, as a leadership team, we need a shared understanding of all of the moving pieces, so no single person is the connective tissue. We fixed this with new communication processes that include the team continuing to meet across all areas of the business when I'm locked away writing, researching, or on the road. We also have a new meeting minutes process. Everyone takes their own notes, but one person in the meeting volunteers to capture minutes. The minutes are narrowed down to the date, the meeting intention, attendees, key decisions, tasks, and ownership. The great thing about this new practice is that everyone in the meeting is responsible for stopping to say, let's capture this in the minutes, not just the minute taker. And now we stop meetings 5 minutes early to review and agree on the minutes before we leave. Before we walk out of the meeting, the minute taker slacks them to all of us and puts them in any other relevant channel, so there aren't any cleanups or synthesizing guesswork after we've dispersed. The minutes process also solves several other ongoing problems, including subjective minutes as a result of one person writing them up from memory hours after the meeting, and keeping our dispersed teams up to speed on the frequent pivots that define a startup environment. This new meeting documentation process, combined with my commitment to copy my team on planning emails with potential collaborators and my publisher, means that everyone has much more access to what's going on across the different areas of our work. We also agreed that we'd work together on estimating timelines and due dates, rumbling on them until we all own them as a team. Today, we've started using a time estimation and project priority practice that seems simple but is effective and wildly telling. We call it the turn and learn. We all get post-it notes and write down how long we think a project is going to take. And if we're looking at several projects that we need to prioritize, we'll write down the projects in priority order. Once everyone has written down an estimate or a priority ranking in private, we count to three and show our answers. This practice controls for the halo effect, which is created when everyone sees what the person with the most influence in the room wants and follows suit. It also controls for the bandwagon effect, that very human instinct to follow suit, even when you disagree. It's tough to be the last to share when everyone is on board and getting increasingly excited about an idea. We call it turn and learn because it's not about being right or wrong. It's about creating space to understand different perspectives, learning from everyone around the table, and identifying areas where we need to get clear on expectations. Most often, we learn that we're all working off different data and assumptions, or that we don't fully understand the lift, or we don't get the load certain people are already carrying. It's a huge connection tool. It was clear that I had some serious personal work to do, and we also unearthed a dangerous pattern that we need to name and deconstruct, a pattern that I observe in organizations all the time, but was in my blind spot. It's operations versus marketing, finance versus creative, the spenders versus the savers, the hearts versus the analytics, the dreamers versus the sticks in the mud. This type of binary thinking is very dangerous because we're not leveraging the fullness of people. The roles become caricatures and stereotypes. Juan is such an optimist with his sales projections. But it's all right because Carrie will come in hard with worst-case scenario numbers and kill those fantasies. We should all be held accountable for being both optimistic and realistic. If you gain a reputation for being an idealist, you lose credibility and trust. If you're forced to be the reality checker, you never get the opportunity to take chances and risk. This insight took us straight into the pages of Jim Collins' classic book, Good to Great. We had done a company-wide read of the book, and even at the time, the Stockdale paradox was something that stuck with us. As Collins explained, the Stockdale paradox was named after Admiral Jim Stockdale, who spent 8 years as a prisoner of war in Vietnam. He was tortured more than 20 times during his imprisonment from 1965 to 1973. In addition to fighting to stay alive, he worked every day to help the other prisoners survive the physical and emotional torment. When he interviewed Stockdale, Collins asked him, "Who didn't make it out?" Stockdale replied, "Oh, that's easy. The optimists." Stockdale explained that the optimists believed they'd be out by Christmas, and Christmas would come and go. Then they believed they'd be out by Easter, and that date would come and go. And the years would tick by like that. He explained to Collins, "They died of a broken heart." Stockdale told Collins, "This is a very important lesson. You must never confuse faith that you will prevail in the end, which you can never afford to lose, with the discipline to confront the most brutal facts of your current reality, whatever they might be." We name this third key learning gritty faith and gritty facts, and today we all work to take responsibility for both dreaming and reality checking those dreams with facts. When stress is high, we can still find ourselves slipping into some of these patterns, especially failing to communicate all of the pieces and to maintain connective tissue. What's powerful about doing this work is that we now recognize it very quickly and we can name it. Once that happens, we know what rumble needs to happen and why. At the end of the meeting, I apologize for offloading my emotions on them. And of equal importance, I made a commitment to make good on that apology by talking about my fears when they creep up and staying aware of the behaviors that fear drives in me. I also checked in with my team to make sure we agreed that if I was successful changing these behaviors, it would address the key learnings that we discussed. Apologizing and backing that up with behavior change is normalized in our organization from onboarding. While some leaders consider apologizing to be a sign of weakness, we teach it as a skill and frame the willingness to apologize and make amends as brave leadership. Reflecting on the key learnings, all of us owned our parts and talked about how we would incorporate these learnings going forward. Examining our part is also critical to the rumble process. I've yet to be in a rumble or any tough conversation, even one where I'm 99% sure I'm totally in the clear, in which after digging in, I didn't have a part. Even if my part was not speaking up or staying curious, we are big believers in what's my part. The power and wisdom to serve others. Joseph Campbell's lesson was that when you find the courage to enter that cave, you're never going in to secure your own treasure or your own wealth. You face your fears to find the power and wisdom to serve others. In that spirit, I want to introduce you to Colonel Dee Dee Halfhill. She is currently the Director of Innovation, Analysis, and Leadership Development for Air Force Global Strike Command, which comprises 33,000 officers and enlisted and civilian airmen. Prior to her current position, she commanded the 2nd Mission Support Group at Barksdale Air Force Base in Louisiana and was responsible for 1,800 airmen and the day-to-day sustainment operations of Barksdale Air Force Base. It was during her tenure as the commander of that organization that the following incident took place. Dee Dee Halfhill is one of my leadership heroes and a total badass. I often think about the story when I need inspiration to choose courage over comfort so I can serve others. Dee Dee writes, "I think one of the most helpful things I've learned from Brené's work is the importance of using the right language to talk about hard things and tackle tough subjects. Conceptually, as leaders, I think we understand vulnerability and are even personally willing to be vulnerable, but we don't always have the right language or practice in applying such concepts. It doesn't really work to say, I'm going to be vulnerable here with you right now. During the first year of my command, I was presenting an award to an airman at a squadron event. At the end of the presentation, I asked if anyone had any questions. A young airman raised his hand and asked, 'Ma'am, when is the ops tempo, which is the pace of current operations, when is the ops tempo going to slow down? Because we are really tired.' 'Yeah,' I said, 'it has been very busy and we ask a lot of you.' I explained, 'It's not just here at Barksdale, though. I just came from a different command where I heard the same thing. Across our Air Force, leaders know we're asking a lot of you, and they know you're tired.' 'Yes, ma'am, we're tired.' While the squadron itself is larger, there were probably about 40 airmen at the event that day. I asked everyone who was tired to raise their hands, and pretty much every hand went up. I thought about Brené's work and the power it's given me to talk about things that are uncomfortable. I went on. I want to share something with all of you that I read recently that has really made me stop and think. 3 days ago, I read an article in the Harvard Business Review, and it was talking about an organization that was researching companies that were reporting high levels of exhaustion. This team went into these companies to see what was driving such high levels of exhaustion. What they found was that while these employees were in fact exhausted, it wasn't just because of the ops tempo. They were actually exhausted because people were lonely. Their workforces were lonely, and that loneliness was manifesting itself in feeling exhaustion." Dee Dee writes, "I stopped for a second and looked out at the group, then continued. Because that's what happens, right? When we're lonely, we just feel lethargic. We don't really want to do anything. We think we're tired and we just want to sleep." I paused. "So if I were to ask you, instead of who's tired, who's lonely, how many of you would raise your hand?" At least 15 people raised their hands. Loneliness is such a hard thing for many of us to admit. I thought maybe one person would raise a hand. But when 15 people raised their hands, I was shocked. For lack of better language, I had an oh shit moment. I really didn't know what to do. Dee Dee explains, I stood there, stunned, in front of everyone, thinking, I'm not a therapist. I'm not equipped for this. I certainly wasn't prepared for nearly a quarter of the group to admit such a raw emotion to me. And truthfully, I'm trying to get through some of the same emotions myself. It was uncomfortable, and the discomfort was making me want to move on to a different topic. But that's where Brené's work has given me courage. 5 years ago, before hearing her work, I would never have had the courage to ask that question, and I certainly wouldn't have been prepared to hold space for the answers. Dee Dee writes, our Air Force, our military in general, is facing challenges with suicide, with people feeling isolated and hopeless. As leaders, we are trying everything we can to reach our airmen and ensure that they know that suicide is not the answer. We spend so much time talking with them about available resources, but I'm not sure enough of us are talking about the fact that in the end, a lot of people are just lonely. They're not connecting, and they're not reaching out. Before I even asked the question, I knew it was going to be very uncomfortable, but I also knew it was an important question to ask. So I decided to call on courage and vulnerability and stay in the moment. I decided to be honest with him. Dee Dee looked at the group and said, this breaks my heart. Loneliness isn't something I've talked about with you before, but seeing so many of you raise your hand today scares me a little because I'm not entirely sure what to do with this information. As a leader, if you tell me you're tired, I'm going to send you home, tell you to take some leave, to take some time away and get some rest. But if what's really going on is you're lonely, then sending you off to be by yourself yet again means that I could possibly exacerbate the very problem we're so desperately trying to combat in our Air Force, which is that some people are so out of hope, feeling so isolated, that they're doing something irreversible. Dee Dee writes, my willingness to ask an uncomfortable question opened the door to a great conversation. We ended the afternoon event having had a very candid discussion about how we build relationships in the unit, how we reach out to others when we're feeling alone, and how we create a community of inclusion. It also provided invaluable insight for the squadron commander and set him on a path to address the right issue, connection and inclusion versus busyness and exhaustion. It was also a pivotal moment in my own leadership growth. I realized that day as a leader, if I am comfortable enough to use the right language and say, are you lonely? I may be able to create a connection that gives someone hope. It's possible that by using the right language, I'll create a connection where maybe, just maybe, they will come and talk to me. And then we can do something about it. Most of the time, if I'm not comfortable with the discomfort that can come from such a moment, and I encounter someone who's having trouble, I send them, and rightly so, to helping professionals, to train therapists. Sometimes I fear, though, that in doing so, I am sending the message, I don't know how to deal with this, or I don't have the space to handle the heaviness of this, or I have so many other demands that I just can't deal with it. As leaders, I certainly believe we all want to do the right thing, but we don't always have the bandwidth or experience to take care of someone the way they need to be taken care of. Sending them to helping professionals is absolutely the right thing to do, but I also think it can add to the feeling of isolation. In some sense, it may feel as if I'm pushing that airman away, and I'm telling them to let the professionals deal with it. The subconscious message that I could be sending is, you are not with me, and I am not with you. That day, when I saw all of those hands go up, it affected me so much that I tell that story every chance I get. I want leaders, I want fellow airmen, to hear and feel for themselves how it feels when we use words like lonely versus exhausted. I've now told the story at least 30 to 40 times to different groups, to people of different ranks and professions in the Air Force. I know I've hit a nerve because every time I tell the story, as I look out at the crowd, I see people nodding in agreement. They're connected. You can see it. You can feel it. They are relating to what it feels like to be in the military, to be away from home, and how hard it is to build community with every new assignment. They're enthralled in what I'm saying in that moment because they too have had their own moments of loneliness. I tear up every time I tell the story because I know it's resonating with them, and I'm sad that we don't talk openly about it more often. In some cases, our lives depend on it.